Okay, we are now going to discuss about the Bhagavisana Sutta. Actually, now we have come to a fair extent of this sutta, and actually it's a sutta consisting many verses, and each and every verse is attributed to the Paccekabuddha. And Paccekabuddha, as we discussed in earlier discourses, is a person who are also self-enlightened, but he does not establish the sasana. Rather, they are basically prefer to be alone, be secluded. So therefore, their practice is very much secluded practice. And once they even realize Dhamma by themselves, they like to spend more time in seclusion. And each and every verse therefore highlights that secluded practice. That's a repeated statement coming in this each and every verse. It is called Eko Chare Khagga Visana Kapu. Let me be alone like a rhinoceros horn, or let me live alone like a rhinoceros horn. So in one sense, rhinoceros horn indicates its seclusion without attaching or associating with anything else. On the other hand, it indicates the stability, strength, very powerful nature is also highlighted. So even though this rhinoceros horn is a single horn, it's a very powerful, strong horn. So that indicates the power of the mind of this particular Paccekabuddhas, and they like to be alone but quite powerful. And now we have come to another verse, and it is going like this: Ragañca dosañca pahāya mohaṁ sandālayitvāna saṅyojanāni asantāsaṁ jīvita saṅkhayaṁ hi eko care khagga visāna kapu. Now certain interesting parts are indicated here. Ragañca dosañca pahāya mohaṁ. Now these are quite understandable. This raga dosa moha are to be abandoned. And now they have already done that. Then sandala yitvana saṅyojanāni. And all the fetters are also removed or sundered. Asantāsaṁ. Now there is no fear. About what? Jīvita saṅkhyaṁ hi. About their extinction of their life. They are ready to die in a way. Eko chare khagga visāna kappu. Having these kinds of interesting qualities, skills, now they live alone like a rhinoceros horn. Now if we consider the background story to this verse, it is mentioned there was a Paccekabuddha called Mātanga, and he seems to be the very last Paccekabuddha in this Buddha era. Actually, before our Buddha arise, Gautama Buddha arise, but this Paccekabuddha is the last one. Now, Paccekabuddhas can't exist when Sammasambuddha exists. So therefore, this Mātanga Buddha was the last one before the enlightenment of the Gautama Buddha, Sammasambuddha. And an interesting point here is that this particular Paccekabuddha, Mātanga Paccekabuddha, boast in an attainment, maybe Arhatpala Samadhi or something. And while he was there, in that absorption, people started to sort of exclaim, telling that there is a arisen of the Buddha. There is an arisen, rising of the Buddha. Now they were quite joyful, knowing that there is going to be a Buddha in the future. You know, when the Prince Siddhartha is born, there are many extraordinary events happen, and the whole world get to know there is something beautiful going to happen in the future. Something extraordinary going to happen in the future. So such kind of extraordinary events are there during the birth of the Buddha or the Prince Siddhartha, and when he was attaining enlightenment, when he is delivering the first Dhamma sermon, and again when he is passing away. So likewise, there are certain events happen in the Buddha, and those are quite extraordinary, and the whole world get to know that something is going on. So similarly, when the Prince Siddhartha was born, so the many people get to know that something extraordinary going to happen in the future, and therefore they get to know that they are going to be a Buddha in the future. And that as a news has spreaded every nook and corner, and certain villagers were quite joyful after hearing that, and they were joyfully uttering that, joyfully explaining that or spreading that news. And it was heard by this Paccheka Buddha, Matanga Paccheka Buddha. So what happened is, so then he understood now his life has come to an end. Now he is spending his last few hours of his life. And he get to know that he is very close to the end of his life. Now, as a tradition, he has gone to a particular cliff where all the Paccheka Buddhas come to the passing away. And once he reached there, he found a certain skeleton of a previous Paccheka Buddha who has already passed away long ago. Now, he simply threw away that skeleton of that previous Paccheka Buddha. Now he also going to attain final parinibbana. In other terms, going to die. But he has no any tension. He has no any death fear. He is quite ready for this event to happen. So this is the point he was uttering this verse, explaining the state of his mind. So his state of mind is quite interesting. So he's mentioning, having abandoned lust, hatred and delusion. Ragancha dosancha pahaya moham. He has abandoned lust, hatred and delusion. Now this is also not something easy. So raga dosa moha are the three roots of unwholesome defilements, and there are many other defilements going to spread or generate through these unwholesome roots. So underneath is nothing but these three unwholesome roots. So this particular Paccheka Buddha, so he is so happy knowing that he was able to abandon all these three roots. Now there is no lust, there is no hatred, there is no delusion. Not only that, sandala itvana sanyojanani. Now he was able to completely eradicate all 10 fetters. Now I have given a little description about these 10 fetters. Now the first 5 fetters are called oram bhagya sanyojana, or the 5 lower fetters, and they are named like self-identity view, that is sakkaya ditti, then the spiritual doubt, that is called vichikicca, then attachment to rituals and vows, what we call as silabbata paramasa, and then kamaraga, that is the sensual lust, then patiga, that is the ill will. Now these 5 fetters are the fetters which people or the beings are being bound to the lower realms, either to the hell realm, either to the human realm, either to the celestial realms. And again, so they are the ones holding us without sort of giving up this whole existence. Now, among these 5 fetters, first 3, probably you have quite familiar with these 3, quite often certain preachers are highlighting it. So these first 3 fetters, Sakkaya ditti vichikiccha silabbata paramasa. The personality view or the self-identity view, and then spiritual doubt, vichikiccha, and attachment to rites and rituals. Thinking that these rites and rituals are the path, or they will bring me certain purification. So if I don't do these rites and rituals, I may not get enlightened. So these rites and rituals are a must. So that kind of a view. Thinking that one can gain fair amount of purification because of rites and rituals. So that wrong view. And on the other hand, spiritual doubts here especially mention about doubts about one's own morality. Doubts about the Buddha, doubts about the Dhamma, doubts about the Sangha, doubts about the cause and effect. So likewise, certain spiritual kinds of doubts are highlighted here. And on the other hand, self-identity view is another very deeply rooted wrong view, where thinking this body is myself, or this body is I am. This whole different kinds of feelings are myself. These different kinds of feelings are I am. All different kinds of perceptions, recognitions. These are myself. Different titles, different recognitions, or different names. I am called this so and so. So this particular name indicates me, myself. I am so and so. So we recognize with that given name, say a given degree, a given designation, a given title. So thinking that all these titles, designations, names, everything indicates myself. So having such kind of a view. And on the other hand, thinking that all these different kinds of skills or creativity or different kinds of thoughts, certain qualities like compassion or ill will or maybe lust or any of those kinds of mental states, thinking that they really are myself. On the other hand, another subtle aspect is thinking that knowing is myself. When I see something, a particular sight, I become a seer. When I hear someone, something, a sound, then I become a listener. When I smell something, a know kind of an odor, then I am doing that part. Say, when I am tasting something, when I am going through certain tangibles, when I am cognizing something. So likewise, all these different kinds of knowing part, we consider as I am. Now these are very deeply rooted recognitions, and thinking that whole aggregate represent a person, represent I, myself, simply we can call as Sakkaya Ditti. Now, if one is able to penetrate this Sakkaya Ditti, so that is one very important aspect of one's achievement or one's realization, because that cuts off a fair amount of suffering that we may be going through all this samsara. Now, therefore, these three fetters are significant, and it is mentioned that when one attains Sotapanna or stream winning, one is able to remove these three fetters. But the other two, if we consider the Kamaraga and Patiga, the sensual desire and the ill will, so those are now prevalent in the mind. So therefore, a stream winner can get angry. A stream winner can have lust. So he or she may spend a household life. But the important thing is they may not conduct some heinous crimes or some transgressions which are causing to reborn in a hell realm. So in that sense, we can say they are lust and hatred are also in a manageable level. They are not strong to take them to the hell realm. And when one becomes a Sakadagami, it is mentioned, that is the once returner, it is mentioned that these Kamaraga and Patiga have become further diluted. It becomes weaker. So it is not that strong. And only when one becomes a Anagami, non-returner, so these two fetters are completely eradicated. So the Anagami is the one who is completely free from these Oram Bhagya Sanyojana, or the lower five fetters. Now, Anagami still has the other five fetters, the upper five fetters or higher fetters. And he, therefore, being bound to the higher realms. So there will be a reborn or rebirth happens in a higher realm, maybe a Brahma realm. So therefore, they, even though they are a non-returner to the human realm or to the sensual realm, they may get reborn in a Brahma realm. So that is where we can understand, okay, these five fetters, which we call as Uddham Bhagya Sanyojana, are more subtle, and therefore it is difficult to remove from the mind. And even they are present in a non-returner's mind. Anagami noble person's mind, still these five fetters are available. Now you can see how deeply rooted these things are, how subtle they are. And only an arahant is completely free from all 10 fetters. The other five fetters, these higher fetters, are completely eradicated when one becomes a fully enlightened being. So those five fetters are ruparaga, where the kind of a desire to exist in a form realm, kind of a Brahma realm, which is simply have a kind of a form, very subtle form. Then aruparaga, the necessary or the desire to exist in a immaterial realm. There is no rupa, but the mind exists. And then the other three fetters are also very subtle fetters, what we call mana, the conceit. And then uddacca, restlessness. And avijja, the ignorance. Now you can see among these three or rather five fetters, ignorance is something available throughout ourselves. Then the restlessness of the mind is also can be visible. And mana, conceit, is also a deeply rooted fetter. So that is why we always either think that I am better than himself, or I am the best. I am comparing myself with another person, comparing myself with my friends, my colleagues, my competitors. So always we are used to compare ourselves. So this comparison is a result of mana. Comparison is a result of conceit. So on the other hand, when we do this comparison, there are going to be a kind of unsatisfactoriness available, going to arise in the mind. So more and more we compare ourselves with others, there are always be certain discrepancies, certain mismatches, likes and dislikes, certain personality problems, many issues are there. And the worst part is thinking that I am better than himself, and he is by quite worse, I am much better. So always thinking that I am better, and he or she is say mean or lower or below. So thinking like that is sometimes we call as atimana, kind of extreme kind of conceit. So even that can lead to a really bad repercussions, bad consequences. So in sometimes in Dhamma it is mentioned, if one is completely bewildered by this atimana, extreme form of conceit, the next life, probably he might be reborn as a monkey or as a dog. Manena makkato hoti atimanena kukkuro. So there is such kind of a statement coming in the Dhamma. So you can see this mana, conceit, it's a kind of a deeply rooted defilement in our mind. So recognizing it is the important thing. And recognizing it and not being a victim of it is the most important thing. Now if we consider these 10 fetters with their corresponding pains, the asavas. Now as I shown in this diagram, the first three fetters, we can say, are belonging to the dittasava. Asavas are the influxes, which are very much like deeply rooted habits, we can say. And they are present during the whole sansaric journey. Even when we are born, so these kinds of tendencies are available in our mind. These influxes, influx of views, then the influx of sense desire, then the influx of desire for existence, always want to become something, someone, and the influx of ignorance. And these are fairly a deeply rooted trait in ourselves. These are traits. So for many, many eons, we were associating certain wrong habits. Now they are deeply rooted in the mind. So mind is now become colored because of these deeply rooted traits. Now removing these influxes needs or requires fair amount of practice. So one has to be mindful, and further one has to develop concentration, one has to develop wisdom, meditate. And one has to restrain one's faculties and how to associate only the good friends and the other conducive environment. And one has to restrain unnecessary or dangerous areas. And further, how to develop the enlightenment factors. And one has to minimize the arising of various defilements. So likewise, a kind of a systematic approach is required to completely eradicate these stains, asavas. So therefore, a person who is completely free from asavas are called an arahant, hinasava. Hinasava is an arahant, the one who is capable of removing all the influxes are called an arahant. And therefore, we can understand only three fetters are being eradicated when one becomes a stream winner. And there we can say he doesn't have the influx of views. The wrong views are not no more in that person. And the influx of sense desire, karma sava, is completely eradicated when one becomes a non-returner. But the other two influxes, that is the bhavasava and avijjasava, are still remaining even in a non-returner's mind. So those two are only removed when one becomes fully enlightened. So therefore we can see some certain deeply rooted defilements are prevalent in our minds, and there should be a kind of a methodology to understand these deeply rooted defilements. So that is where we need to develop mindfulness, and not only with mindfulness, that one has to develop fair amount of concentration. With that, one has to practice fair amount of wisdom. And through that practice, if one is able to recognize at least a temporary release of mind, temporary freedom of mind, non-grasping state of mind, so that one can use as a sort of a reference, as a foundation, as a starting point in one's future spiritual journey. Now you have found kind of a triggering area or kind of a base or a kind of a stand, a kind of a reference which you can use to further recognize these fetters. Now, when one dwell in that reference, or when one dwell more and more in that more purified state of mind, then an interesting point happens. So that is the losing of or loosening of the defilements, or the diluting of the defilements. Because more and more one associates that pure state of mind, non-grasping state of mind, non-proliferative state of mind. So one's mind is now free from proliferation, mental proliferation, too much thinking. Rather, one may experience a fair amount of inner stillness or inner silence. So more and more when one becomes capable of maintaining such inner silence, so Buddha mentioned in certain suttas like Madhupindika Sutta, he doesn't encourage proliferation. So typically we encourage proliferation, we like to think more and more, we like to think again and again, we like to think in many different directions, and we are sort of addicted to thinking. But when one develops a fair amount of vipassana, so one makes one's mind fairly restrained and arise various insights, and that helps to maintain fair amount of inner silence, tranquility, understanding in the mind. Then mind is not cluttered. Mind has fair amount of clarity, and one can enjoy this inner silence. That is more productive. So that is where what Buddha mentioned in the Madhupindika Sutta. For another person, a particular site may be quite lucrative, quite prolific, and therefore he may, going after that, write poems about it, write songs about it, and think about it, proliferate about it, overthink about it, and even can one become obsessed about it. But for the practitioner, that site is nothing but a site. He just has seen it, that's it. There is no proliferation happens in the mind. So Buddha mentioned, if one is capable of maintaining such kind of a restrainment in one's mind, seeing is just seeing, hearing is just hearing, the tasting, smelling, and this going to the bodily understanding, sensing, and even cognizing, is just that. There is no second thought. There is no any agitation in the mind. Then Buddha mentioned, for such person, all these different traits available in the mind, those habits available in the mind, deeply rooted tendencies in the mind, are started to dilute, started to sort of calm down. They are not taking chance to wake up. They are now very much like not getting chance to use, not getting chance to get activated, and therefore they start to lose. Therefore they start to become weaker and weaker. And in other sense, this is mentioned in the modern, what you call this brain sciences. So they say, use it or lose it. Whatever the circuits in the mind, or sorry, the in the brain, you have to use them. If you are not using them, you got to lose them. Use it or lose it. So in a way, we can see kind of a relationship between this present finding of the brain science and the teaching of this vipassana, where one is not using these traits. Now one is not agitating these or activating these traits without giving any opportunity for those traits. One is maintaining inner silence, restrainment. As a result of that, all these traits are now calming down. They are deactivating. they are diluting, disappearing, fading away. So therefore, it's an interesting finding of the Buddha, mentioned very clearly in the Madhupindika Sutta. Each and every anusaya, latent tendency, is mentioned there. So one is, if one is maintaining such kind of a practice, Buddha mentioned, raga anusaya will be eliminated. The deeply rooted tendency towards lust will be eliminated. Deeply rooted tendency towards ill will or hatred will be eliminated. Ignorance will be eliminated. So likewise, all the list of tendencies are mentioned there. So therefore, non-proliferation, non-agitation, maintaining inner silence, in a way give a very interesting path towards an Nibbana, towards the complete eradication of raga, dosa, moha. Having abandoned lust, hatred and delusion. So, don't know whether the Paccheka Buddha has followed the same path, most probably. And he has completely uprooted all 10 fetters. And now there is no fear in him about his death, final parinibbana. And now he is living this last moments like a rhinoceros horn. So with that information, with that sermon, I like to conclude today's Dhamma teaching. Now I like to open the session for questions.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
We have currently 7 questions. First one is mindful sitting. Dear Bhante, after a few years of mindfulness practice, I try to observe thoughts during my sitting practice these days. I have been encouraging the participants who have some experience to establish mindfulness to naturally shift to... Sorry, you have been... what did I read it from the beginning? Sorry. Yeah. Dear Bhante, after a few years of mindfulness practice, I try to observe thoughts during my sitting practice these days. You have been encouraging the participants who have some experience in establishing mindfulness to naturally shift to observing thoughts. My question is regarding the initial stage of this approach. After establishing mindfulness using the body, starting with the breath, and after the breath fades away, I can focus on the thoughts. I can feel when thoughts arise against the empty space and the loss of serenity in this empty space as a quality of this observation. Or I can simply note a thought arise and after some time it fade away without focusing on the quality of the thought, just as a transaction rising and falling, fading away. Which technique is appropriate for a novice like me who used to focus on the bodily phenomena all this time? Thank you. Much merit for your guidance. With metta.
Yeah, actually, it depends on the mindfulness and clear comprehension. So, Buddha mentioned you have to have a fair amount of clear knowing. So, with mindfulness and clear comprehension, Buddha mentioned, okay, you are now ready to observe the mind. So, observing the mind is a little tricky because unlike observing the body, where the bodily phenomena is in a way a little gross, physical, compared to the mental phenomena. Mental phenomena is more subtle and you have to observe mental phenomena using the mind, using the mindfulness. So therefore it is a little tricky. So therefore the most advisable method is to use the body as your preliminary practice, preliminary object, and to develop a fair amount of mindfulness. And as we develop a fair amount of mindfulness, then the clear comprehension also comes to the picture. And you are able to distinctly know what is really going on. Then automatically you start to watch the mind as well. Now you may understand, okay, certain emotions are present in the mind. I get sometimes get angry. I become lustful. Certain times I get jealous. Or I have certain compassion, or sometimes I have certain loving kindness. So different kinds of states of mind now you are able to recognize. Rather than promoting them, or rather than being a victim of them, or rather than driven by them, now you are able to stand back and look at it. Have a kind of a second person's perspective. Now, this is an area now you can start where you are watching the mind and you are able to step back and watch the mind. Like you are able to step back and watch the body when it is walking. You allow the body to walk during the walking period or mindful walking, and you completely experience or observe the whole walking process like a second person, like an outsider. So similar approach now you are taking in the mindfulness on the mind. Different thoughts are arising in the mind, but you know them. You are able to recognize them. Okay, this is a lustful thought. This is an angry thought. So likewise. So this is where if you have this skill, then you can directly move towards that area. Yeah.
Question number two. This is a general question. Dear Venerable Sir, much merits for your service. I have been connecting to this program more than a year and quite happy about the walking and sitting practice. Thank you for your guidance. In day-to-day life, I find myself not relaxed and not composed. I often get carried away by strong feelings and emotions for my possessions and people around me. I find myself obsessed with the house I live in and try to do various non-essential upgrades and changes. I am attached to the car I use and try to keep it in an immaculate condition and want to get a new or better one all the time. With people around me, I always get attracted to the pretty and beautiful ones and want to get closer to them and associate them. Earlier, I used to think that this is the way, but now I feel guilty and frustrated about my acts. I see how my mind is jumping around like a monkey all day, which I cannot control. However, I cannot change the job or move to any other location soon. Rather than thinking about the toxic environment, I used to turn towards myself, but don't know where to start. My mindfulness is not enough to stop me getting caught up or attracted to various indulgences throughout the day. Appreciate your valuable advice. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually, I think this is where we all begin. So, understanding that we have certain shortcomings, I'm still with lust, I'm still with anger, I'm still with lot of desires and lot of ambitions, and I have certain mishaps, shortcomings in my, say, my sila, morality. So likewise, this is a kind of a very honest reflection we have about ourselves. And if we have that reflection, then we can take certain corrective measures. And therefore, it is not something for you to be sorrowful of. Rather, you can understand, okay, previously I didn't have even this kind of an understanding. But I was simply driven by these various desires. I'm like a slave. Various desires are always operating in the mind and they have taken a ride of me. But now I can recognize these desires and I understand, okay, certain desires are completely useless. Not necessary. No need to fulfill them. They are merely desires. And so this is a very interesting understanding. So this helps to change our way of life. Now you got some kind of a idea. Okay, rather than just moving with the trend, how about looking back? How about having a different alternative path? So, and you don't need to have a kind of a regret, because then the regret is another defilement or another hindrance. So rather than regretting about what you didn't, okay, let me correct myself. Everyone has done some, say, foolish things in their own life. So that is everyone's manner. But now if I have some better idea, a correct idea, more spiritual idea, let me practice it. So therefore, don't worry about what you did in the past. Now try to further develop mindfulness, further develop a fair amount of concentration and wisdom. That will show you the path. It is not that I am showing you the path, rather your own wisdom, your own mindfulness will give better direction. Because it is very much like self-monitoring. Now as we develop mindfulness, it generates fair amount of self-monitoring. and again sometimes we call as a self-regulation. So now you are not immediately jumping into various actions driven by various desires. Now you can do some sort of a regulation. And again, you are always monitoring yourself, whether it is correct, whether it is wrong, whether it is useful, whether it is necessary or essential. So likewise, you do this continuous assessment. And as a result of that, you can only select only the useful part. So this is a result of development of the mindfulness. And Buddha very beautifully mentioned, Sati dovariko bhikkave arya savako savajjam pajahati anavajjam bhaveti. Suddham attanam pariharati. So Buddha mentioned mindfulness is like a gatekeeper. And he understand, okay, this is correct, this is incorrect, or this is wrong. And he removes the wrong and he only encourages the correct, the right. As a result of that, his way of life become more and more purer. So this is the common thing to everyone who develops the practice. So therefore, I encourage you to continue your practice. And this continued practice, the developed mindfulness and wisdom, will show you a better path.
Question number 3 of 7. This is a Dhamma Saman question. Dear Bhante, if one comes across the realization or Chetu Vimukti, are these signs that we get to know about it? Are there signs that we get to know about it? Do we hear them in the practice reflections or Kamatahan reports? And how often? With Metta.
Yeah, actually Chetu Vimukti is not only in the Vipassana. One can even experience it even in the Samatha practice. That is what last week we discussed about the Metta Chetu Vimukti. That assume that you develop a fair amount of loving kindness, more and more loving kindness, and now you are able to have that loving kindness available every time, or rather in more stronger manner, and you can spread that loving kindness to the east direction, to the west direction, to the say north direction, and to the upper direction, lower direction. So likewise, you are very much like a source of loving kindness. Now what happened to the boundaries of the mind? Now typically we select a certain person or myself and I can love that person. So in that way, I narrows down my mind. And on the other hand, we can select a certain group of people and to that certain group of people, I can love. Or I can like. All the others I don't care. But that actually narrows down the mind. But the Metta Chetu Vimukti, as an example, it doesn't have such boundary. All the beings, not only the human beings, all the beings in the, say, in the front direction, and I can spread Metta. May all those beings in the front direction be well and happy. May all beings in my right direction be well and happy. May all beings in my rear direction be well and happy. All beings in my left direction be well and happy. All beings in the upper direction be well and happy. All beings in the lower direction will be, may be well and happy. So likewise, now we are expanding loving kindness. Now expanding loving kindness inevitably expands your mind. Now, previously you have a very focused, narrow mind. Now you are expanding it to a certain direction, you are expanding. To another direction, you are expanding. To the other direction, you are expanding. To the other direction, you are expanding. So likewise, you are now fully enhancing your mind, opening your mind. This is where you get a mind, freedom of mind. Now there is no boundary to the mind. So your cognition is not limited to a particular object, a particular group of object. Rather, it is spreaded all around to the whole universe. That is where we call as Chetu Vimukti. And it is possible either using Samatha practice or even using the Vipassana practice. And people are talking about it. So it is not something very rare. But many people nowadays, they discuss about it. And they sometimes achieve it using the Brahma Vihara practice, Metta, Mudita, Karuna, Upekkha. Or sometimes they use vipassana, and through vipassana sometimes they are able to practice it.
Question number 4 of 7. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, I am looking at my thoughts and try to observe the nature of my mind during the day. When I hear or see what is going on in Ukraine now and the plight of these people, I observe sadness and helplessness. I don't know if this is compassion. Compared to greedy, lustful, angry states which we can identify readily, what are these thoughts which arise when we see injustice? Much merits. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually, on the other hand, we can see in a different manner. So yesterday also we discussed one sutta called Kalaha Vivada Sutta. So there are some similar question is asked from the Buddha. So what is the reason for all these disputes, quarrels, wars, etc.? And Buddha answers more simpler manner. Buddha mentioned that is because of the availability of likes. Certain people have certain likes to a particular thing or particular person. So when you like something or like someone, and you want to have him or her, or you want to have it or that, whatever it is. Now you want to have it, you want to own it. Now you don't like to share it with someone else. So if we consider the deeply rooted causes in our mind, so they are the ones ultimately causing a huge trouble. I would say, for example, a certain person want to have his own something and he like it. He want to control it and he don't want to share it with someone else. Now someone else is also now want it. Now he is trying to obtain it. Now then there's a kind going to be a quarrel, going to be a war. Now this is the situation throughout the whole samsara, and we can't say it is only limited to today, but it has been the situation even in the good old past. During the Buddha's time, there were many wars. Say, for example, the king Pasenadi Kosala had wars with many other kings. And the king Ajatasattu, he had quarrels, wars. And the king Vidudaba, he completely murdered the whole Sakyan clan while Buddha was alive. Now this is the situation. Now actually it is true that we can say, I mean, we are being shocked, we are being disturbed by looking at these things. It is true, but everything indicates fair amount of human ignorance, the operation of various defilements in the human mind. So, I mean, if we want to have a lasting solution, it is nothing but to uproot the defilements. We can have a kind of a temporary solution. Temporary win, temporary victory is possible. But then the loser somehow try to gain whatever the weapons and all these things, and again he attack. So it's a never ending process. Say 50 years, one side may win and they enjoy, and the loser will slowly, secretly gather whatever the weapons and etc. Then again he attack. Again, there's a war. So it's a never-ending process. So in other sense, we can't have a solution for everyone. Because, I mean, then everybody has to get enlightened. So that is also not possible. So in a way, the solution is very much like individual. So there's a very interesting verse available in the Dhammapada. Jayang Veram Pasavati. Jayang Verang Pasavati. That means Upasanto Sukhang Seti Hitra Jaya Paraja. I can't remember the other phrase. So what that particular Dhammapada verse mentioned is whenever there is a quarrel, whenever there is a war, whenever there is a competition, there is always a winner and the loser. And the loser is always sort of unhappy, disappointed. And he has kind of a hatred towards the winner, the victor. So therefore, the approach Buddha mentioned is the person who is simply dwelling oneself, not encouraging this kind of a competition, not encouraging such kind of a victory, war, whatever it is. Rather, he eliminates both defeat and victory. So don't know, I mean, it is not an easy task in a way, because we are driven by kind of a competition. During the school days, say we have a kind of a competition. We want to become the first in the class. We want to win the race in the, say, 100 meters, in the sports meet. And we want to become the first. So likewise, I mean, maybe the Olympic or whatever it is. So always the competition is highlighted, competition is promoted. And sometimes it has some advantages as well. But more than that, if we are not taking it proper perspective, then we are promoting very much a self-view. We become more and more conceited. And the loser will have a lot of anger or aversion or want to get revenge. So those kind of things are there. So in a way, we are promoting defilements. So we can look at the whole situation more deeply like this.
Question number 47. This is a Dhamma Samana question. Dear Bhante, I'm new to the practice, started a year ago with MYA program. So far, I have listened to and taken time to review and reflect on three key Dhamma talks and suttas: Anapanasati Sutta, Mahasatipatthana Sutta, and Sabbavasa Sutta. What is the fourth sutta that Bhante recommends for someone at this stage in the process of building a practice? Much merits. That's a good question.
Well, let me see what are the things available there in MYEA session. I also can't remember. I need to check what are the things available there. So you can go to the next section, Chamila. So while I am checking the whole thing.
Okay. So question number 6 of 7 is again a Dhamma Sermon question. Dear Bhante, referring to today's Dhamma Sermon, what is the link between self-identity view, Sakkaya Ditti, and conceit, Mana? Is there any link between them? Much merits. That's the end of the question.
Can you repeat? Interesting question.
Yeah. What
is the kind of a link between conceit and the self-identity view?
Yes. Yes. Sakkaya Ditti and Mana.
Mana. Actually, we can say that Mana is more subtle, and around that Mana, the Sakkaya Ditti has become more gross. And it not only has a self-view, but more than that, it has more ignorance in a way. Say, for example, considering this body, whole body as myself. So I am taking a huge, huge entity as a single thing. And I call it as I am. This is I am. This is myself. Say you are watching a previously taken photograph. There are a group of people are there. And immediately you recognize where you are. And you say, oh, here I am. Here I am. Look at. Here I am. So here we are indicating the form. Form as myself. So likewise, when we are going through various feelings. So we consider this. There is a person who is feeling. There is a person who is recognizing. There is a person who is thinking. So all these different processes we are attributing to a person. But on the other hand, when we consider mana, so there is a kind of a center point. While keeping our self in that center point, I do all these measurements. That is how the whole grammar being developed. Okay, I is there. With respect to I, he is there. With respect to I, you are there. So these terminologies, the grammar, the tense is developed like that. So I is the, I think the, I mean, the, what is that called? plus tense, right? Can't remember now. Can't remember Sinhala, can't remember English. So anyway, at least you understand I, you, he. So these are the three terms. So whoever in front of me, I call as he. Whoever not in front of me, but I can refer him, he is whoever in front of me is, I can call as you. And then whoever in, not in front of me, but at some other place, then I can call him as he. But the center, the reference point is I. With respect to myself, with respect to I am calling this terminology. So that is a very deeply rooted sense. That is sometimes called as asmimana. The I am. It's a very subtle form of defilement, and we are using that for the whole measurement, whole comparison. So therefore Buddha mentioned, so that kind of deeply rooted defilement one can eliminate by seeing how these five aggregates or the clinging aggregates happen again and again. So whenever clinging happens, then the I arises. The notion of I arises. So the notion of I promotes this this person or the conceit. There is I. With respect to I, there is him. With respect to I, there is you. So it's a bit, a little complicated in that sense when we are thinking about it. But on the other hand, when we are able to observe the mind, we can understand how I make myself, I make a person, I make an individual. We are making a self, we are making I, we are making mine. So those are to be recognized. So therefore Buddha mentioned, one has to understand this I making, mind making and the conceit. So we can say there is a relationship, but Sakkayaditti is more gross. But the conceit is more refined, deeply rooted.
Question number 7 of 8. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, my question is regarding using mindfulness practice in day-to-day life. I have come to use the practice in analyzing situations in the day-to-day life and realize that you can use it in any situation. I have a confusion though and would like to clarify. Example is, if I am doing something in the house and something goes wrong, for example, cooking or cleaning, the situation would generate some emotions. At this point, I would either analyze the emotions and watch how that emotions rise and fade away. Also, sometimes I would analyze why I am feeling these emotions and realize that it is to do with me having so much I making, like I can do this. People expect me to do this and I have failed. It will reflect badly on me, etc., etc. My question is, from these two perspectives, which one should I do? Should I try to observe how the emotions rise and pass in my body? Or should I analyze why I am getting these emotions? Much merit for your answer and time. With metta. That's the end of the question.
Actually, both are correct in a way. Two approaches. So you can, we can simply see how they come and go. Emotions are arising and emotions are passing away. So that is one approach. And on the other approach, as you have mentioned, you can see why this emotion is arising. Then you are applying more yoniso manasikara, wise reflection, and trying to find out the roots, trying to find out the causes. So, maybe you can take both approaches. For example, say there are many emotions are available, then you can't do the second approach, can't take the second approach because there are many emotions are there. Then you can simply see how they come and go, how they come and go. And now your mind is somewhat settled, but time to time certain emotions are now coming. Now at that level, you can probably understand why this particular emotion is again coming. Now I handled them to some extent, Now there are no many emotions, but time to time there are certain emotions are coming. Why is it coming now? Now you can go even deeper and understand, okay, maybe as you have mentioned, I do certain eye making, mind making, or I have a kind of a personality trait. I used to think like this manner, this in this particular way. So that promotes this kind of thinking so that it will lead to an emotion. So likewise, certain more subtle aspects may be able to reveal. So I feel therefore, I mean, you can try both. I feel maybe this kind of an approach would be more useful. But by the way, I mean, even though I am also talking, so philosophically, sometimes these can be when we are applying practically. So, I mean, sometimes we can't even remember how to handle it. Simply somehow do it. Because when we are going through a certain situation, we can't, I mean, exactly remember what is the best method. Whatever comes to the mind, I am simply handling it. So, I mean, therefore, by the way, I mean, we can learn them. We can sort of prepare how to handle them. It's not a bad thing. But really, when we go through them, it's a kind of an impromptu action.
Question number 8 of 8 is the last question. It's a general question. Mante, what's the difference between mama and vemi? Metta.
Yeah. I am. Yeah, very interesting question. Actually, we have to think. It's very, very subtle form of situation. So Buddha mentioned, "Etam mama eso hamasmi." Etam mama eso hamasmi eso me atta. Say for example, with respect to something else, I can denote existence of myself. So that I feel it is the second part, that is the vemi. Say you have a car. When you have a desire about the car, it promotes that there is a person, there's an owner. So I am the owner of this particular car. I have a great desire to this car. I love this car. Now the existence of I is now being promoted because of this relationship. But on the other hand, even without that, I have a kind of a feeling that I am living. Not necessary to have even that kind of a object, but still I feel that someone is existing. I am there. So likewise, there may be very subtle differences between these kind of, say, feelings. We can use the term feeling. Okay, I is another thing, but vemi, so I am, is have a different sort of taste in a way. Actually, those are something interesting to deeply look at or to understand how I am feeling now. Do I feel that I exist because of its own original sense, or I exist because of the help of another thing with respect to something else, because that it promotes a person? So when you see the car, okay, now immediately you see, okay, I am the owner of this car. So it promotes a person. It promotes an owner. It promotes a rich person. Say, for example, it's a very rich, very expensive car. The others don't have that kind of an expensive car. So more you look at it, probably the conceit may arise. Probably kind of a proudness arise. The I is going to exist more and more, because that object promotes a person, promotes conceit. But if that is not available, still some existence is there. Still we have, okay, I am there, I am living. It's more subtle in a way. So I need to also look at it more deeply. I am just explaining to you some knowledge. But I can't say this is the best answer. But these are something we need to further and further explore. What are the very nuances or differences available in these terminologies and in these kinds of feelings, what we are taking or what we are going through. By the way, very interesting question, and therefore, please give a good answer if you find a better answer next time.
I will come to the end of questions today, Bhante. So, and you've okay. gone a little bit over time as well. So, I would like to conclude the program. First, I would like to thank Bhante for his valuable time in participating in this program and providing us with the guidance for the mindfulness practice and answers to our questions, and also enriching our Dhamma knowledge with the Dhamma talk. We would first like to pass our merits to Bhante. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Also, we would like to pass our merits to everyone, both seen and unseen, who are enabling this program. And we pass our merits to the participants for joining the program and presenting questions and encouraging the organizers and making this program possible. Until next time, Theruvan Sarnai. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Theruvan Sarnai, Theruvan Sarnai.